Tomorrow, hundreds of marches and rallies will happen across the country to take a stand for science. The March for Science in Champaign-Urbana will be led by K-12 students.
The future of science, the future of the planet, really belongs to them, and we want them to lead the way. We want students to know from a young age that not only is science important, but their voices are important.
We'll talk with March organizers from Champaign and Peoria, and also with PhD physicist Bill Foster, now a congressman representing Illinois' 11th Congressional District, about why he'll be participating in the National March in Washington, D.C. Plus, expectant parents may worry a lot about things, but a common concern is, how do I make sure my pet is prepared for the baby's arrival?
There are lots of changes that are coming, with lots of the things that dog is going to have to get used to that's going to be possibly stressful for the dog.
We get tips from an expert on children and pets for how to prepare, and we speak with Chicago-based cellist Tamika Reed, who'll be performing in Chicago tonight. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, sitting in today for Nyla Boodoo. Tomorrow, scientists all across the world will rally in what's been called the March for Science. Gatherings planned on the National Mall in Washington, D.C., hundreds of other cities around the country and the world. It started as a grassroots social media campaign and grew into a nationwide effort to take a public stand for science. And it comes during a time when many scientists feel that scientific research is under attack. In a few minutes, we'll hear about events being planned right here in Illinois. But first, I'm joined by Congressman Bill Foster. He's a Democrat, and his 11th congressional district includes part of Argonne National Laboratory in Lamont. He is also a PhD scientist who spent more than two decades as a physicist at Fermi National Accelerator Lab in Batavia. Congressman, welcome back to the 21st.
Well, happy to be back.
So the March organizers have put out a platform for the event here tomorrow. You know, there's many reasons people cite for coming out and participating. What are you marching for this weekend?
Well, I think it is primarily for science and also for fact and evidence-based policy decisions.
Meaning
both are important.
So meaning what?
Well, you know, if you look at the progress, you know, in society over the last, several centuries, it came from transitioning from a rule of strong men to a rule of law and for policies that are based on facts and evidence instead of just opinions. And it's been the source of progress economically and the progress in our society.
So what do you see as the role when you say, you know, facts and evidence-based policy? What should the role, what should that look like, I suppose, in when it comes to policymaking in Washington, D.C.?
Well, almost every decision we face has a technological component to it, and often a non-technological component. So an example of that was the Iran nuclear deal, where an important part of it was the administration's representation that there was, for example, a one-year breakout time.
Mm-hmm.
That if Iran kept their part of the bargain and then quit, that we had at least a one-year response time before they could get their hands on the fissile material for their first nuclear weapon. Now, that's a technical and scientific question. You have to look at the equipment they're allowed to have under the deal, what they can do with that equipment, and will it take them a year to produce the first bomb's worth of fissile material?
Mm-hmm.
And then separate from that, that, however, is not dispositive of your decision on whether or not you support the Iran nuclear deal. If it is not true, if what the administration had been saying was not true, that would be an important factor in voting against it. But after, more than a dozen classified briefings from the weapons laboratories basically talking about Iranian capabilities and our ability to detect things, you know, I came out and told my colleagues publicly and privately that I supported the one-year breakout time that was such an important part of the deal.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, there's a second part, which is a psychological and diplomatic estimate of the reaction will be of Iran, you know, the day after we voted up or down and the decade after we voted up or down. That is psychological and diplomatic and not a directly scientific question. And you have to respect the difference between the technological facts that must be understood to make a decision that often has a non-technological component.
And you know, in a somewhat unique position there, just being one of the few with a PhD in a scientific field and sort of having to walk both of those lines there. You know, you recently told Stat News that you'll be attending the march not as a Democratic member of Congress, but as a scientist. Can you explain that? What do you mean by that?
Well, the organizers of the Science March have wisely said this is not, you know, a partisan movement. You know, there, for example, will be few, if any, politicians speaking. at the rally.
Mm-hmm.
But this is something where science and evidence-based policy should not be a partisan issue. And so they're not focusing on the partisan aspects, which, you know, is actually a little bit difficult because, frankly, Donald Trump's administration is a motivating factor for many of the people and some of his early indications on his policy decisions.
Is that a motivating factor for you as well?
Partly. I think it's very important that we stay with evidence-based research. We've had some very interesting hearings in the Science Committee, which is one of the two committees I serve on. The first committee hearing that we had of this session of Congress was called Making the EPA Great Again. And so you can imagine, with three Republican witnesses and one Democratic witness, the nature of the discussions we were having.
Yeah.
So it's difficult to keep some of these nonpartisan, but in the end, if you talk with people who are seriously engaged on the science, you can find common ground.
Well, and I wonder, too, I mean, it is difficult to make it nonpartisan, because some of the organizers have said that it is very political. Some have said it's not partisan. Others disagree and say it is very partisan. You know, I wonder, you're a Democrat. You're a member of Congress. You know, much of what you are involved in, there is a partisan nature to it. Why work so hard to say that it's not partisan? And do you think by framing it that way, do you risk losing, maybe what some say is an important message that science is important at a moment when there are a lot of scientists saying they need a very direct response?
Well, I think that you risk, if you make it partisan, you risk losing a number of, very thoughtful and competent members on the other side of the aisle who do respect science and do care about the economic impact that science has on our society. And many of them are in a very tight box politically. And as a fellow politician, I respect their constraints. You know, if you come from coal country, there are things you can and cannot say about carbon dioxide, and without paying a very large political price. And so I don't think you do a lot of good in alienating those members of Congress who, in almost all areas, are strong supporters of science.
How do you think, or do you think, I guess, Congress would be different if more scientists were elected and were holding office?
Well, when I entered Congress, I was the third PhD physicist in Congress. We had Vern Ehlers, who was a wonderful moderate Republican from Western Michigan. You then had Rush Holt, who is now running the American Association for the Advancement of Science, one of the main organizers of the Science
of the March.
And he represented the area around Princeton and famously campaigned with bumper stickers saying, "My congressman is a rocket scientist." but he's also, a very thoughtful scientist and understands the value of science-based policy. And the other motivating factor among scientists are the threats to the budget, the science budget. This is something it's something I struggle with all the time. It's the difference between short-term political benefit that you can get, for example, by claiming that you're a hero because you balanced this year's budget, by cutting things with long-term payoffs, like fundamental scientific research or mm-hmm. early childhood education or, long list of things that don't give a direct advantage in the next election, but are crucial to our long-term economic growth.
And by having a background in the sciences, you're saying that you understand, or people in your position understand a little bit more about the implications of that and those longer-term benefits, I guess.
Yeah, there's a big asymmetry in the time that it takes to create a scientific program, which often takes decades to assemble the team, assemble the knowledge base, and often the laboratory to study a scientific subject. And then that can be destroyed in a single budget cycle by zeroing it out. And if you look at the numbers in the so-called skinny budget that the Trump administration has proposed, it has a lot of scientists deeply worried about the scientific leadership of our country.
Just not to get too deep into that budget there, but what are some of the risks that you see based on some of what is at least initially proposed in that budget?
Well, they're essentially zeroing out climate research essentially every place they can, or NASA research looking down on the planet instead of out to the stars. And so this carries a big danger that we will not understand what is happening with our climate, and then make policy decisions based on a lack of knowledge that could affect our planet for generations. So that it is, to my mind, tremendously cost-effective to understand, have the best possible climate data and climate modeling, because depending on the timescale at which we have to fix global warming, then it will cost a very different amount of money. If we have to fix this in the next 10 years or the next 20 or the next 30 years, there's a big difference in the upfront cost.
So with all that in mind, and we've only got about 30 seconds left here, unfortunately, but you're marching this weekend. It's likely to get quite a bit of attention. And then what? What do you hope happens after everyone goes home?
Well, I think I hope a small fraction of those scientists who march will go and decide they want to run for the school board or the city council or even for mayor and eventually become my colleagues in Congress. And that's true no matter what party they come from. You know, as the only PhD scientist in Congress, I feel pretty lonely sometimes.
Well, that is Congressman Bill Foster, Democrat, 11th Congressional District, Naperville area, here in northern Illinois. Thank you very much. I appreciate you spending a few minutes with us.
Oh, thank you, Scott. Happy to be here.
Well, the big National March for Science is set for Washington, D.C., but as we mentioned, there are hundreds of other events around the world. Let's talk now about two of the organizers of events right here in Illinois that are taking place tomorrow. Joined in studio by Elizabeth Sotoropoulos, organizer of the March for Science Champaign, and on the line with us from Peoria is Megan Bond, organizer of the Peoria Rally for Science. Elizabeth, Megan, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, no, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Both of those events are taking place tomorrow. We'll tweet out all that information if you follow at 21st Show. I have that information also available on our website. Elizabeth, let's start with you here. You know, what made you decide to organize a march here in Illinois as opposed to, say, traveling to D.C. to participate in a bigger national march?
Sure. So I own a business locally, and I teach math and science as part of that. And so bringing these big marches and really anything at the national level to Champaign-Urbana is really important to me. I wanted to provide a way for local residents of Champaign-Urbana to participate in the March for Science and to make their voices heard. It was really important for me to bring this March for Science to Champaign because I wanted this to be by the community for the community. So I wanted to be sure that our message was representative of what CU residents want and something that would be beneficial for everyone here.
And you mentioned that, you know, you're a teacher, you do work, you know, with students and whatnot, and the March in Champaign is actually a youth march. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. So everyone can march in our March for Science, but it will be led by K-12 students from any school in Central Illinois. Everyone is welcome. And how that happened was because of the Illinois Marathon and Ebert Fest that will be taking place the same weekend, we were afraid we weren't going to find a large enough space to have a larger march. And so the first place we were able to get was smaller, and we were thinking we're only going to be able to march around a parking lot. But fortunately, we were able to get more space downtown, and we were able now to invite everyone to march with us. Nice. But the idea behind that is we are having K-12 students lead the march because the future of science and the future of the planet really belongs to them, and we want them to lead the way. We want students to know from a young age that not only is science important, but their voices are important. And when they see something that is wrong, we want them to feel confident that they can speak up and they can say this is wrong and it needs to be fixed and that everyone else will listen.
And give a voice there.
Yeah.
I'd like to talk a little bit more about some of those driving factors here. But just getting to Megan and Peoria there, you know, you're going to have several speakers there. It's a rally in Peoria. You know, you've got folks from the local planetarium, professors talking about the history of science. What is the message that you're hoping to send there in Peoria?
What we're trying to have in Peoria is a celebration of science. We want to convey the message that science is for everybody. It affects everybody, and ideally, everybody should be participating, which is not always been the case for a number of reasons. We really want to bring science from up on high, where it often is, down where everybody can experience it, and emphasize science education. We're actually raising money. We've sold T-shirts, and we've got fundraisers for, we've partnered with the local Peoria Public Schools Foundation to offer a scholarship in the sciences for local children.
Yeah. And what about some of the bigger things going on? I know the organizers of the national event, you know, the idea sort of percolated out of early on in the Trump administration. The EPA was sort of restricted in what they could say publicly. You know, what are some of the driving factors? We've only got a minute here before a break, but that got this started for you that you're trying to communicate and talk about this weekend.
You're absolutely correct. That was the initial driving force for the foundation of the National March. It is both the National March and our local marches. They are nonpartisan, but they are political, unfortunately, because science is political. It affects everybody, regardless of where you live on the globe. And this is something that policymakers from every level, from local to national, they need to take proven scientific information into account when they're making policies. And unfortunately, that isn't necessarily happening. And we're trying to show that people are genuinely concerned about this.
Well, we're talking about the March for Science happening tomorrow in Illinois and multiple communities, talking about Peoria, Champaign-Urbana, happening in Washington, D.C., hundreds of other cities, talking with Elizabeth Sotiropoulos and with Megan Bonn, two of the organizers of events here in Illinois. Stay with us. We'll be back to continue this conversation in just a moment. You're listening to The 21st. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Scott Cameron. We're sort of getting a bit of a preview of the March for Science that's happening tomorrow at multiple communities in Illinois, also in Washington, D.C., kind of the big rally and march on the wall, mall. Excuse me. I'm talking with Elizabeth Sotiropoulos, organizer of the March for Science in Champaign, on the line with us from Peoria, Megan Bonn, organizer there of the Peoria Rally for Science. Elizabeth, just coming back to you for a minute here, you know, the March for Women drew a large turnout earlier this year. There have been marches around immigration and other issues. Now the March for Science. What is it about this moment that's driving, you know, you and the organizers to march and to rally?
That's a really good question. So right now we have a lot of problems, a lot of injustices that are going on in our country. A lot of those injustices have been happening for a very, very long time. But many of us were unaware that it could also now affect us. It could affect science. There have been a lot of non-truths that have been spoken about science recently, and a lot of times some of these side beliefs about science and what is true and what is not, there are small groups of people that hold these things to be true, but now there's
and you're talking about maybe climate change.
Exactly.
And other arguments.
Vaccine safety and GMO safety and so on. And it's good to question, but at the same time, we are having elected officials come out and say things that are absolutely untrue, and that is threatening our planet, it's threatening our environment, it's threatening a lot of different facets in science and also social issues. So we are coming together to promote education in science, to promote diversity in science. These are two very, very important things to all of the organizers. And so we have a lot of things in common with these other marches that have happened. In fact, we have a speaker who's going to be talking about how the immigration ban affects scientists. We have a speaker who's going to be talking about how the lack of funding for HIV/AIDS back in the 80s really contributed to how serious that epidemic was, and many people died as a result. Are we doing a better job now? Sadly, the answer looks like no. It looks like we haven't learned our lesson, so we want to go back and fix that.
Well, Megan, and turning to you for a minute, you know, throughout the planning process, both at the national and the local level, you know, there have been some disagreements about, you know, what the purpose and just how big of a scope the March for Science should have. You know, some saying that the event should focus on issues that very directly and clearly affect the practice of science, funding, evidence-based policy, some of these we talked about. Others then arguing that the march must draw attention to much broader issues, including some of the things that Elizabeth just talked about, racial diversity in the fields, women's rights, immigration. You know, what kinds of conversations have you been having or hearing there in Peoria about that that issue?
From the start, we definitely wanted to focus on diversity to get a wide variety of speakers because, unfortunately, a lack of diversity has plagued the STEM field for quite some time now, and that is something that we did want to draw attention to. And I know that they're focusing on that at the national level as well. We have a variety of speakers from different backgrounds, and we're really hoping that their own personal experiences are really going to help people connect to see what science can offer for all of us.
You know, and I can see Elizabeth over here nodding, but thinking back, you know, earlier in the show we spoke with Representative Bill Foster, a Democrat from the Naperville area, is a PhD scientist, you know, now representing the community there in Congress, participating in the March for Science in D.C. tomorrow. We asked him what he hopes to see happen next. You know, what comes after everyone goes home from these marches and these rallies tomorrow? Elizabeth, what do you think? What do you hope comes next?
We've talked about that quite a lot, and one terrible tragedy that could happen is that people come out to march and go home totally unchanged. So we are telling people at the march to come with an open mind and to leave behind your personal biases, to listen to what the speakers have to say and to realize it's not just, quote unquote, them who is doing all these wrong things in terms of science and other social issues, but it's really all of us. All of us need to fix something that we are doing wrong. So what the CU March for Science is doing is after our march, a week after our march, we are having a Science in the Community networking event at the Champaign Public Library. It'll be Saturday, April 29th at 10:30. And we are going to bring in different groups, ones that focus on research or education or activism in our community, because we want people to sign up for those and to get involved and stay involved. We also encourage people at our march to register to vote and to vote in every single election. And at a very fundamental level, check your facts. You know, before you share things on Facebook and so on, ask yourself, is what I'm sharing true? Is it helpful? Is it necessary? We want people to be more careful about what they are sharing, both on social media and just in regular conversation.
So giving people some tools to go along with the motivation coming out. And
right.
Megan, how about you there in Peoria? What comes next or you hope comes next out of this?
We are also looking into what we can plan to have afterwards because we definitely want to keep the momentum going. We're considering trivia nights. We're going to look into the broader networks that we can form from this one-time event. I know that the national organization, they are going to do something like what the Women's March does, 10 actions for 100 days, actions that you can take for the week after, for the month after, for the year after. And it's definitely something we want to focus on because that is a very real danger is people turn out for the one day and we wave our signs and we wear our hats and then we go home and nothing changes. But I am optimistic because the main reason that I got involved in organizing our local march was because I had gone to our local women's march the month before. And so I saw that what could be done on a local level away from D.C., just by ordinary people.
Yeah, so at least one example of somebody grabbing onto that and sort of continuing and making a difference there in the community. It's Megan Bond, organizer of the Peoria Rally for Science, also speaking here with Elizabeth Sotiropoulos, organizer of the March for Science in Champaign. Thank you both very much, and good luck at the march and the rally tomorrow.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo today. And bringing home a new baby means big changes for first-time parents. It can also be a big adjustment for the pets in the house. So what can you do to help them get ready? Nyla Boodoo earlier spoke with Alicia Obando. She's the owner and president of Pitter Patter Parenting in Chicago and specializes in helping both parents and pets prepare for that transition.
Alicia, I imagine in all of the preparation for a new baby, oftentimes do pets kind of get left out of the equation?
Yes, it's very true. They can be an afterthought sometimes.
And so is it because of that that makes bringing a new baby home hard for pets, or are there lots of other reasons too?
Well, I mean, obviously there are a lot of changes that are going to be happening for the parents. And so they're understandably busy preparing themselves and their home and their schedules and everything for, you know, the changes that are coming with the baby. Unfortunately, the dog doesn't get to know ahead of time what's happening. So they don't necessarily know how to prep. So we have to do some preparations with them so that they can get ready for all those changes that are coming. So it's not just the baby that's coming, but there are so many other changes that come along with the baby. And those things really have to be prepared for ahead of time.
And is this something that's primarily an issue with dogs, or does it happen with other pets as well?
Well, it definitely can happen with other pets. I think people usually are more concerned with dogs as far as, you know, the bite factor. But sure, I mean, cats can also get upset, and generally if they get upset, they're just going to go into hiding. So it's a little different scenario. So people are usually mostly concerned about their dog's reaction.
And what happens if you don't prepare a dog or for the transition?
Well, the dog can definitely experience a lot of stress. They don't know what's happening. They don't know why there's all these changes going on. And when I talk about changes, it's not just the baby coming home, but it's all of the equipment that goes with the baby. There's usually a lot of pieces of equipment that make noise and that move and that light up. They may cause rearranging in the home for the equipment. Maybe where the dog's bed has always been is suddenly moved because a crib's going to go there. So there's lots of changes in the environment. And then there's also a lot of changes in scheduling. Sometimes the whoever walks the dog is going to be changing. Maybe you're hiring a service now because you don't have time with the baby. So that's a big adjustment. So there's all kinds of changes that the dog has to get used to and they're not aware of. So we want to make sure that, you know, they're given time to prepare to decrease their discomfort and stress level, which, of course, can decrease any problems from happening.
Before we get to the problems, what are good ways you think prospective parents can prepare, particularly dogs, for a new baby?
Try to prepare them for all those changes that are coming. So start integrating those changes way before the baby comes. So if you're going to be having somebody else walk the dog, then hire that person to start weeks in advance instead of starting when the baby comes. And if there's, you know, additional services that you're going to be using, maybe a daycare, your dog's going to now go to daycare, or maybe he's going to board sometimes, any of those kinds of changes, if you can start practicing those ahead of time. Also, you really want to make sure your dog has his basic manners down. So if you haven't been to dog obedience class yet, you know, get that done in advance. Your dog should know the basics of sit, down, stay, how to go to their place or to their bed. It can be very useful. You want to get all of those manners down ahead of time because you're not going to have any time to be doing dog training once that baby gets here.
Well,
and then the other things, like just taking them to the vet, making sure all their shots are up to date, that you've got plenty of food and treats on hand, whatever you can get done in advance.
Well, speaking of time, Alicia, that's obviously something that's a really tough thing for new families. Would you even suggest starting showing the dog less attention or spending less time with the dog to kind of like ease them into that? Because that's probably inevitable once the baby's around.
Well, there is definitely something to be said for teaching the dog how to kind of entertain themselves, how to be okay with spending some time alone. So in that sense, yes, you can teach them. I mean, your dog hopefully has learned and utilized a crate. If not, that's something you want to teach in advance because you're going to want to be using ways to keep the dog involved in the family but separate in a safe way, such as by using baby gates and crates. So teaching the dog to, you know, be able to hang out in his crate for half an hour with a really tasty treat is something that you're going to want to utilize once the baby comes. So, yeah, practicing some of those kind of times where he's going to be alone but okay with being alone. And, you know, getting some of those puzzles that they now have in all the pet stores, you know, for mental stimulation for the dog, that's a good way to keep a dog busy. So teaching them ways to entertain themselves, to be okay with being by themselves is definitely a good way to start practicing.
And so what if, despite all of that, there are problems that arise, whether they're behavior problems or I mean, I think the worst case scenario parents are always worried about is like, what if a dog bites the baby or something like that?
Well, once the baby does come, it's really important that you provide full awake supervision the entire time that the baby is in the same room, the dog is in the same room with the baby. So if, you know, if the baby and the dog are going to be in the same room and they're not separated by a crate or a gate or tethering, then you are going to want to be there fully present, paying attention. And if you can't, which of course there's many times when you have other things to do, then you really do need to make sure that there's separation. And those, you know, obviously preventing the problem from happening is the best way to go. But then, yeah, if you have any concerns, if you, you know, feel like the dog is showing any signs of you know, stress or discomfort or you know, possibly into aggression, you really need to seek out a professional. And those are some things, too, that you're going to want to try to do in advance. If you have any resource guarding issues, which is when the dog really values something and gets upset if you come near him when he's got that special something or try to take it out of his mouth and he growls or snaps at you, that's considered resource guarding. That is something that you really need to pay attention to because obviously, you know, toddlers might want to take something out of the dog's mouth. You don't want a dog reacting like that. And you're going to really want to get a professional trainer in your house working with you before the baby arrives if you know you have those issues.
And when you mention toddlers, I know some of the services you provide include classes for children to help them learn to take responsibility for their pets and be safe
yes.
in the process.
Mm-hmm.
At what age is it appropriate to start training a child to interact appropriately with a dog, for example?
I think you start right from the beginning. You know, how to, you know, pet a dog. Toddlers are just learning kind of their how to grasp, and so it's very difficult for them to learn to pet gently. They just want to grab, which often, you know,
and just pull hair, right?
Mm-hmm. Dogs don't like, yeah. So using what they refer to as guided touch, where you're using the baby's or the toddler's hand. The baby doesn't need to be petting the dog, but once the dog is mobile and shows an interest, or the baby is mobile and shows an interest, you want to take their hand and kind of slowly guide it over the dog so they understand how to pet. And that's something you start, you know, as soon as the child is mobile and interested. But then, yeah, once the child gets older, my classes actually start at preschool. So we teach 3 to 5 year olds with a curriculum that I have called I Speak Doggy, where the kids learn a song all about how to and when to interact safely with dogs. So it's really important for all kids, even if they don't have a dog, because their friends have a dog, their grandma has a dog, the lady at the park has a dog. So all children will have opportunities to interact with dogs, so they should all learn how to do it safely.
And Alicia, what if you get to the point where there are some families who just think they can't handle this, they can't handle a baby and the dog, or I have to add, in the case of one of our producers, can't handle having 2 children, 2 dogs, and a baby on the way. I understand mm-hmm. a lot of your work involves helping families that are thinking of giving up their pets to find ways to make it work. What kind of advice do you offer?
Well, hopefully the ideal situation is they don't have to give up their pet. It can often be very traumatic for a dog to lose its home, and it can then have, you know, some concerns, you know, some issues that arise from that for the next owner. And so that's, you know, obviously not the ideal situation, but there are times where perhaps you're going to have to. And then the best thing you can do is find a home yourself. If there's any way that you can reach out to friends, family, coworkers, so that dog can go from home to home and not have to go through the shelter system is always best. The shelter system is definitely, as you know, shelters do a wonderful job doing what they do, and thank God we have them. But obviously it can be a very traumatic experience for a pet to have to go through a shelter. So really working with all of your contacts to find your own home would be the best way to go.
Well, Alicia, thanks so much for joining us. Alicia Obando is the owner and president of Pitter Patter Parenting, and we've also been just talking about her volunteer-run nonprofit, Pets Are Like Family, where she's based in the Chicago area as a child and pet care professional. Alicia, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo. Thank you. That's the music of Tamika Reed, a Chicago-based cellist who draws from both jazz and classical music, playing a show in Chicago today at the Symphony Center, and she spoke with Nyla Boodoo last week.
How do people respond when they hear the interesting mix that you often have in your music?
Well, I think people enjoy it. I think people are happy to see a cello in that context because it's not, I mean, it's not, I'm not the first one, of course, to do that, but it's not super common. So I think people enjoy seeing, you know, hearing a cello function in that context.
Yeah. How did you end up in this space? What was your path to this musical space for you?
Well, I had a mentor when I was an undergrad who encouraged me to try playing some other kinds of music besides classical music. And at first I was a little bit like, I need to finish learning these, you know, sonatas and concertos that I was working on. And then when I moved to Chicago in 2000, I joined up with a really great flute player named Nicole Mitchell, and I joined her ensemble. And so then through that, I just started doing more improvisation and playing, you know, doing free improvisation and then also playing in jazz contexts and stuff like that. So that's kind of how I got more steeped into that kind of music or this kind of music.
And is it different for you when you're playing your music in different settings? Is it different for you when you're in Symphony Center and you are doing something, for example, how different is your mindset when you're doing something with, for example, CSO versus doing, as you said, like jazz improvisation?
Well, I guess I'm, when you say that, I'm thinking more about the space and like just playing in like a big hall like that is pretty awesome to think that, you know, you work so hard and then for this to be an outcome is really amazing. But I also really love playing in smaller venues as well, because I feel like that's where I really came up in this music in Chicago, playing at the Velvet Lounge and Elastic and Hungry Brain and now Constellation. So, yeah, I guess I was thinking more about the space. It's pretty cool to be asked to be on this series. It's definitely an honor.
Yeah. For you, I wonder, is it different depending on the audience too? Does it matter to you how the audience is responding to your music?
I mean, as a musician, you always hope that people enjoy. I hope that people come away with a positive, feeling uplifted, come away with a positive experience or come away with thinking, oh, wow, like, there were some weird sounds in there, but there are also some pretty sounds. You know, I want to have different moods and, you know, just because I feel like as people, we have many dimensions to our personality. So I like to reflect those things in my music as well. So there'll be really pretty moments and there'll be also be some other moments that are dealing with sounds and textures and stuff, because I really enjoy putting those elements into my music that I write.
Yeah, I was thinking about it. I was asking that because I recently was speaking to the Jupiter String Quartet, and you know, they were talking about chamber music and just sort of how the energy of the audience sometimes influences them when they're playing as a quartet. And just wondered for you, I wonder especially if it's a piece when so much of it is your own work, if that ever comes into play.
Not really. I mean, really, I just hope that people are uplifted by it. You know, I like it when people say, oh, that really touched me, or I was in a space before I came to your concert and I feel happier, or I feel, you know, a certain way afterwards. But I guess I don't really go into writing hoping to get an audience reaction, because you have to write what you feel inside, you know. I think for you to convey a personal true message of yourself, you know. Mm-hmm. So I don't always think about my audience in that way, except for I hope that they are uplifted by what they hear, or I hope that they are changed for something positive after what they've heard.
Let's take a listen to one of your songs. I'm speaking with Tamika Reed. She's a Chicago-based cellist This is a little bit of a piece called 17 West. It's off your debut album. As a band leader of the Tamiko Reed Quartet, which is actually performing this evening in Chicago at Symphony Center, let's take a listen. A little bit of 17 West. It's off the debut album of the Tamiko Reed Quartet. Tamiko Reed is on the line with me now from Chicago, where she's based. Tamika, you know, you're also you're a candidate for a doctoral degree in musical arts at the University of Illinois. And as I was thinking about, we were listening to that, I was thinking about a piece that you wrote that you debuted in Urbana a couple months ago called Present Awareness. I wanted to ask you about that. I mean, when you're thinking about your music, I wonder where what kind of space you're in right now when you're thinking about writing. Does it sort of, is it something that comes from your kind of where you are personally right now?
Yeah, I would say that. And just everything that's kind of going on in our, you know, in our world, at least, is, you know, there's a lot of heavy stuff happening and, you know, trying to figure out how do you make sense of it, and realizing that making music and playing is important, because sometimes you're like, oh my gosh, there's just so much craziness. Should I do something? What else can I do to help in these various situations? But I think we need art, we need music, so that's how I'm going to contribute.
Yeah, that was part of it was called the Black Composer Speaks Showcase. And, you know, as I'm thinking about that, I was thinking about a group we had. We had a group, I'm sure you're familiar with, the guys from Black Violin. They were on the program a couple months ago, and was talking to them about stereotypes, how much of their work is about sort of breaking down stereotypes, like sort of two young Black men who, you know, are playing and mixing in. You know, they're also, I think, in a different genre than you, because they're mixing sort of, I think, a lot more hip-hop into classical music.
Yeah.
You know, you're like in a different space of jazz and that. I wonder, is it frustrating when you're in that space where people kind of are trying to put a label on you and say, oh, but you're mixing genres. I wonder how you feel about that.
I don't think anyone has really said anything like that to me so far, to be honest. I don't know. I mean, I think that's just the beauty about Chicago. It's like you can just kind of, it encourages you to develop your own voice and to do what you want to do and play music that's true to you.
So said that, I wonder, and I think about Chicago, and I think about so much of the incredible jazz scene that's in Chicago. Where do you draw your inspiration from?
Wow. I guess from, you know, the talented musicians that I'm around in Chicago, and, you know, when I think about, you know, people like Kellis, for example. Abdul Adud is one of my chill heroes. I love Billy Bang. I love, you know, the other great Stuff Smith. And I love Eric Dolphy. The tune you played, 17 West, was written by Eric Dolphy. You know, I love, you know, the wonderful people I play with, like Nicole Mitchell and Dee Alexander and Mike Reed. And, you know, I guess I just draw inspiration from all of that, you know.
Yeah. Well, listen, Tamika, thanks so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. Before we go, we're going to listen to one last song from you, but a reminder to our audience, the Tamika Reid Quartet is playing this evening at 8 o'clock at the Symphony Center. That's where you can catch her. You can find her other tour dates at tamikareid.net. We'll tweet out all of that link, right?
Sweet. Yeah, that's great.
Cool. All right, Tamika, thanks you so much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me.
And let's take a listen to one last song. This one's called Etoile.
With Chicago cellist Tamika Reid talking with Nyla Boodoo. I'm Scott Cameron, sitting in for Nyla here today, and that is all the time we have for today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Just search for The 21st, also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa, easy to find there. Just tell her, ask NPR to play The 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, and every other way to contact us via phone, email, social media, it's all on our website at 21stshow.org. You can also follow us on Twitter. Search for 21st Show. We live tweet during the show with more analysis, background about all the things that we're talking about. On our Facebook page, search for The 21st to like us there. You can comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments of things you want to ask us on the air. We're produced by Christine Herman and Alan Montecilio. Abrar Alhiti is our intern. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft with engineering support from Steve Mork. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Scott Cameron. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.